Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled Spiritual Achievement and Faith in Contemporary Buddhist Thought. Our speaker is Dale Wright, the Gamble Professor of Religion at Occidental College. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel.
I think anybody who's sensitive to the dilemmas of religion in the contemporary world will be fascinated by the topic of this series. Faith and doubt are central concerns in many of the religious traditions of the world, and they're central to the formation of the philosophy of religion as a discipline and as a preoccupation within the larger field of the study of religion. Tonight we turn to the tradition of Mahayana Buddhism. When we started to plan this series last year, I was fascinated by the paradox expressed in a famous formulation of the Bodhisattva vow in the Diamond Sutra. As many living beings as there are in the universe, I vow to lead them all to final nirvana. And when this innumerable, immeasurable, infinite numbers of beings has been liberated, we do not think in truth that a single being has been liberated. That's the Bodhisattva vow from the Diamond Sutra. This is a basic, down-to-earth expression of the Buddhist quest for enlightenment. And could it also be a basic, down-to-earth expression of the relationship between faith and doubt? That's the question. And to help us answer this question, we welcome Dale Wright, the Gamble Professor of Religion at Occidental College, and one of the most respected authorities on Buddhism and comparative philosophy in American universities. His recent book on the Six Perfections, Buddhism, and the Cultivation of Character tackles exactly the question we are dealing with in this series when we talk about faith as one of the virtues. Tonight, he's going to be speaking on spiritual achievement and faith in contemporary Buddhist thought. So join me, please, in welcoming Professor Wright to Boston University. Welcome, Dale. Yeah.
It's an honor to be here. This is a long-standing, famous lecture series, and I'm honored to be a part of it. I'm going to start with a Confucian proverb, which, of course, isn't Buddhist, but here we go, where one of the Analects says something like, and this is a something like because I've altered it a little bit, "Those who learn but do not think are lost. Those who think without learning are hopeless." Okay, so this is by way of assignment to you. That is that if you learn what I have to say, or if you learn what you read in a book, but don't think about it, don't submit it to the question, well, okay, that's what they think, what do I think? In other words, unless you engage it in critical thinking, that you're lost. You're not doing anything with what you've learned. On the other hand, if you set aside, you don't bother with anybody else's thinking, you don't bother engaging in dialogue, you don't bother reading because you're a thinker and you can do it all and you're starting from scratch, Confucius says that's hopeless. I want to begin by clarifying what I mean by ethics in my title and in my talk by making a distinction between morality and ethics. Two words often, as you know, used interchangeably, right? Oftentimes you hear those seem to mean the same thing. I'll do this by offering a stipulative definition, which means that rather than defining something in terms of its true essence, what it really is, or rather than saying sociologically what most people mean when they use a word, I'll simply stipulate what I will mean when I use the word ethics. So it's sort of a cowardly way to get out of controversy when you want the controversy to be elsewhere. You want the critical thinking to focus elsewhere. So ethics for me here will be defined for our purposes as the overall quest for human excellence. enlightenment in Buddhist terms. While morality is one dimension of that quest, where you attend to the needs and well-being of others so that your own quest doesn't unjustly interfere with the pursuits of others. So ethics concerns the overall discipline of shaping your life, what you really ought to do in every part of your life. Well, morality concerns one very important and central dimension of ethics, right? So ethics is the big term. Ethics is a more limited term. Ethics, morality, then, what you should be doing in relationship to other people. Okay, so moral questions ask how to give others their due. Ethical questions concern what kind of life to live and how to go about doing that. Okay, so given that definition of ethics, one way to understand the overall quest for Buddhist enlightenment is as an ethical undertaking, a quest for self-transformation that includes a very large and very important moral dimension, right, as part of it. There are certainly other ways to understand enlightenment in Buddhism, as an inexplicable mystical experience, as the deification of a human being, as an end to the seemingly endless cycles of rebirth, and so on. But in early Buddhism, and in ongoing lineages of the tradition, in every Buddhist culture throughout Asia, the ethical understanding of enlightenment has remained intact, and often alongside other options that go with it, okay? So the discipline of ethical self-sculpting in Buddhism all fall under the broad category of meditation, the enlightening activity par excellence, as you know, for Buddhists. For most, the most general Sanskrit Buddhist word for meditation would be bhavana, which may translate something like bringing into being or developing or cultivating, which is the same sense in which I'm using the artistic metaphor sculpting, right? Of sculpting your character. That's what this form of meditation means in general, to develop and sculpt and cultivate. In the early tradition, Buddhists distinguished between two overall styles or intentions in meditation. First, practices that sought to calm and concentrate the mind by quieting or extinguishing compulsive thinking. And second, practices that make extensive use of those same thinking processes. So one is sort of putting thinking in the background, and the other is bringing it to the surface. So both of these, calming meditation and insight meditation, have throughout the history of Buddhism been considered essential to the ethical enterprise. One form calms, concentrates, centers both body and mind, while the other aspires to alter the practitioner's understanding of and relationship to both self and world. Many meditation techniques entreat practitioners to focus intently on a thought or a set of thoughts and through many repetitions, over and over, to ponder it so thoroughly that they come to embody it. Neuroscience now gives us good reasons to use that metaphor, coming to embody something, because in fact, it's literally true, we now know. Whatever we do with our mind, whatever simply happens in our mind against our will or even awareness, is gradually etched into the neural structure of our brain. All mental activity builds specialized neural pathways, while all mental inactivity allows previously developed pathways to simply wither away. With every part of your brain, you either use it or lose it, because whatever occurs or doesn't occur in your mind is shaping the internal structure of your brain and therefore affecting your character. Although they couldn't possibly have understood this, that all this was taking place at the level of neurological structure, early Buddhist meditation masters sought to locate enlightening thoughts and feelings and motives and to meditate on them to the point of absorption into their character. So, what insights did they recommend that we internalize through meditation? Well, the list isn't endless, but so long that it might as well be endless. Here are some samples, basic principles of Buddhist thought. One, all things are impermanent. Dwell on that thought. Try to find something that's not. Understand how things are impermanent. Or, all things come into existence dependent on prior conditions and causes and a vast network of inner causality. Or, another basic Buddhist idea, there's no eternal soul or foundational self because all things, including you, are impermanent and conditioned. Or another kind of meditation topic, here we're switching to another sort, avoid the damage to character that can be caused by greed, hatred, anger, sensual desire, And imagine what it means for you to be, for example, a resentful person or a violent person. Or, on the other side, focus your mind on dimensions of human character that were regarded as exalted in life, as parts of enlightenment, so that you gradually come to embody these traits like generosity, morality, tolerance, energetic effort, meditative depth, wisdom. In meditation, you simply picture these ideals. I shouldn't say simply because complexity is beyond belief, but you imagine these ideals of character. You analyze them. You look for authentic forms of them, counterfeit versions of them. You imagine what it would mean for you to be a generous person or a tolerant person or a wise person. What does that mean? What would that be like? In meditative focus, you valorize these ideals, holding images of them in your mind, constantly, so that they gradually become part of your brain, your actual brain structure, so that they either become an option available to free choice that you can choose when you come into a life situation where they might be useful, or they simply become a default mechanism built in your character. So given enough pre-meditation on, say, compassion or generosity, when you encounter someone in need, you really can set aside other inclinations that push you in other directions and choose to be helpful, or just do that naturally without deliberation, because it's a built-in default mechanism at that point. The overall image of enlightened human life composed of these various ideals, like generosity, wisdom, and so on, were called bodhicitta, thought of or image of enlightenment, where thought or image means includes a range of feelings and motivations and visualizations and aspirations. So it's a composite image of ideals of human character, a current image of who or what you would choose to be if you really could choose, if it was in your power. Buddhists recognized relatively early in the tradition how important that thought or image is, since it guides the practices of ethical self-sculpting, right? It's the image in terms of which, or in view of which, you shape yourself into the kind of person who you're going to be. Okay, now that's broad overview, setting the stage, the context. Now I want to raise some more specific questions that are hopefully pertinent to your theme of faith and doubt and other ones having to do with ethics and virtue ethics in Buddhism. Anyway, we'll begin to dig more deeply into these. First, I want to ask where this image comes from, this thought or image of enlightenment, or more importantly, how can it be potent enough, let's say you have one, or attractive enough to empower a quest for enlightenment, given how difficult, unrelenting that quest is? So even if someone has a desire for self-transformation, whether they're Buddhist or not, how can the momentum of that desire be powerful enough to sustain the quest, given how initially unrewarding all of this feels or can seem? Just try any of the arduous practices of Buddhist meditation, even for a day or two, and I promise you'll be asking yourself, why am I doing this? What's really the point? Isn't this an incredible waste of time and nothing's changing? What's the point? You can hear yourself saying. So what we're asking here is, what kind of inspiration would be strong enough, powerful enough to sustain that? What would compel people to, and this is in more explicitly religious terms, to be a devoted Buddhist practitioner or a serious follower on this path of self-discipline? Okay. One Chinese Buddhist text, conveniently for our purposes, entitled The Awakening of Faith, articulates a moment of internal change when a thought of enlightenment arises that's powerful enough to activate and enable a discipline of meditative self-cultivation. This moment of conviction is considered an initial awakening, right? You wake up for the first time. A strong realization that you're not yet who you ought to be and you feel that you ought to be different and that you must change your life, right? It's a sense that you've got to change. So when this occurs in a vivid experience, your life has already changed, right? Nothing will ever be the same after that. Even if you do nothing, you will always feel guilty about not having done anything. So even if the real work of intentional self-sculpting is yet to be accomplished, still your life will have been changed. The difference is now you know what you must do, kind of, sort of, initially, beginning, and that you can do it. And that's what this initial experience of faith would entail. So in the discipline of religious studies, some of you know, this has come to be called a conversion experience, obviously with Christian overtones. Whether the transformation occurs in a person suddenly, as in the case of St. Paul on the road to Damascus, for those of you who know that story, or very gradually, as in St. Augustine's guilt-ridden but liberating confessions, we can see that a revolutionary conversion has occurred. How the transformation occurs and what inspires it differ widely, not just across traditions, but within any particular tradition. We have dramatic accounts of one form of this in the New Testament, where the focus is on the immediacy, on the unhesitating character of the change evoked by something or someone there outside of a person. In this case, it happens to be Jesus. So when Jesus says, simply follow me, it says the disciples do that immediately. Like this, they don't think, should I do that? No, they're doing it. So in Luke, we have accounts of someone with slight hesitation where one guy says, sure, I'll follow you, but first my father's just died and let me go home and take care of the funeral, to which Jesus says outrageously, I mean, think about saying this, he says, let the dead bury the dead, right? Just checking on you guys. So let the dead bury the dead. Can you imagine saying that to somebody? You know, your father's died, let the dead bury the dead. Jesus says this, okay? And then in another story, somebody says, yeah, you know, I think I will follow you and we'll do this. I'll be a disciple. But I need to go home and tell my family first, you know, say goodbye. And Jesus says something weird about getting your hands on the plow. But what he really means is you're not ready, that you haven't really been transformed to the point where this is what matters. Totally, this is what matters. And so so faith is here characterized as an inspired reversal in life, a conviction so strong that doubt, in some forms, is pushed to the background. So let me show you this an example in Buddhism, where there's lots of these. But now, the word conversion isn't wholly inappropriate in the context of Buddhism, because a new version, a conversion, version of yourself begins to unfold. But better to call it an awakening or an arising or something else in order to align with Buddhism's own metaphors. In any case, something has happened that has changed your life. So widely known accounts of the life of the Buddha, and many of you know these are way late accounts into the tradition before anybody got around to writing the life story of the Buddha. But in these stories, they present him wandering around, calling out disciples amongst those who he encounters, and summoning them to a life of spiritual self-transformation, to a new kind of life. Now, let me just tell you one story. Some of you know this story. Remember in the life of the Buddha, how many people know, have heard a little bit about the life of the Buddha? Yeah, okay, half, more, a little more than half. Okay, anyway, there's a place where at the end of his long career of training, Gautama, the Buddha-to-be, is with five ascetics practicing asceticism, right? Which is you're doing some self-torture in order to put your spirit, make it dominant over your body, right? Mind over matter. And so they fast, and they sit in the sun, and they meditate long hours, and it's very torturous. At some point, Gautama realizes he's just getting emaciated and skinny, and he's weak. And in Buddhist art, he's pictured as this, you know, just skin and bones. There's nothing left because he's done this asceticism so strongly. And he goes and sits under a shade tree, and accepts some food from a woman who passes by and sees, you know, obviously, young man, you need to eat. And the other ascetics reject him and say, okay, Gautama is turning to sensual indulgence, you know, he's eating all his food, you know, forget him, you know, we're leaving him. So they go off and leave him. He stays there, I don't know, weeks and weeks, months actually. Finally, long story, very short, becomes enlightened, and then he's there a long time deciding, well, what do you do if you're an enlightened person? And finally he decides he's going to teach, and he sets out to go to Benares, the holy city of Varanasi. And on his way, kind of there's lots of people, but he runs into the five ascetics again. Right? There they are. They see him coming, and they say, don't, oh, here comes Gautama, ignore him, you know, the sensual, indulgent fool, you know. Pay no, don't even recognize him, just pay no attention. But when he walks up to them, they look at him, and it's like, wow, what happened to you? And he begins to explain what happened to him and begins the Buddhist teaching. It's the first sermon in Buddhism. And even at the end of that sermon, supposedly somebody experiences an awakening of what sort, we don't know. In any case, they are all compelled immediately to forget about their agreement. They agree, we're not going to talk to this guy. And suddenly they're all talking to him, right? They can't help it. So there's something compelling that's happened to them. So it's quite like the story in the Jesus accounts. Now, I'm concerned here not with whether the events described in that narrative ever happened or not, but rather with the structure of religious discipleship or conversion that's shown in it. The question is, how can we describe and account for that kind of change that's being accounted for here in these narratives, asking, to what might we attribute this kind of radical reversal of mind and intention when they do occur? Right? What would be potent enough to compel me or any of you to change our minds so suddenly and so persuasively? It doesn't appear to be an intellectual sense that somebody there knows the truth or has all the answers. That doesn't seem to be it. Nor a commandment to follow imposed on them through fear and intimidation. That's not it. So what? How can we conceptualize an attraction of sufficient magnitude to account for someone giving up their former life to follow a new one? Or what one Buddhist scripture, the Lankavatara Sutra, calls a revolution occurring at the very base or foundation of your character, right? Deep down in the center of you, there's a revolution going on. So here's my hypothesis, or I guess we should call it a thesis. You know what the difference between a thesis and a hypothesis is, but here's what I think. That this awakening of faith, as the text called literally, this welling up of conviction, could only have this kind of compelling force if what we experience out there in another person or a text or anything else, and we'll see examples of lots of things, if that, in fact, is some fundamental dimension of our own identity. Right? So on this account, what the first disciples experienced in the Buddha wasn't a commandment from the other, but rather a profound sense of their own being, their own highest possibility, their own freedom. That's what they saw out there in another person. Couldn't see it anywhere else, but that's what evokes the transformation. In that case, because it's their own identity and not something alien to them, they're able to follow it immediately without hesitation. That's my thesis. Think about that. This awakening of faith, as the Buddhist text called it, would, from this angle of vision, be a recognition of your vocation in life, a potent sense of being summoned to do what you can now see you really should be doing. Right? That's what you experience. You recognize what you should be, and you now see that that's what you need to be doing. Rather than being imposed on you or against you, this is something experienced as truly yours. That, it seems to me, would help account for experiences of faith that are immediate and unhesitating, and this would therefore be the sense in which faith does indeed undermine doubt in one sense. But in saying that, let me distinguish between forms of doubt. The form of doubt that we valorize when we juxtapose doubt to faith is critical thinking, right? The courage, the skill to raise crucial questions, and what I've asked you to do, and to face answers wherever they lead, no matter what, even if it hurts, or you have to change your mind on fundamental beliefs. Here, self-doubt is honest self-scrutiny, the rare ability to face up to difficult questions about your own perspectives, your own motives, and your own many things. A second form of doubt is one that we avoid whenever possible, because it renders you unable to, or unwilling to, or unable to decide or to act. Self-doubt in the second form is fearful and confining. It's hesitant. Out of insecurity and fear, it seems to demand of us that we don't do anything until we have absolute certainty, a full guarantee that what you choose can't go wrong, which, of course, we never get, leaving you stuck in place without the nerve to take risks in life. When it becomes obsessive, this form of self-doubt leads to stasis, self-loathing, and so on. Now, imagine an awakening of faith that enables an immediate, unhesitating response that undermines our fear, undercuts our fear, and pulls us out of indecision and self-doubt. Since it actualizes as confidence and strength, that's how you feel it, such an experience would in fact make critical thinking and energized effort possible. Doubt in the disabling sense is removed, while doubt as courageous critical thinking is activated. That is, critical thinking helps, in fact, get the ethical enterprise underway. Faith in this sense provides the confidence to get something going in life. But that's really a tautology. You know what tautology means? Two words that mean the same thing. Faith is that confidence. In fact, the word confidence in Latin, cum fides, means literally with faith, right? So if you have confidence, you have faith. So faith in this understanding of it is that confidence, deep trust, courage that empowers action that wasn't possible before, whatever it is, because in a very vivid sense, something about your own identity is at stake, right? That's what's at stake. So it empowers your action. So in this description, we should all hope for such an experience. It's not necessarily the Lord calling, but something basic to your own identity right there in front of you that you sense in a profound, life-changing way. We can't make this happen. It just does or it doesn't, although work on ourselves in this sense of ethical self-sculpting can certainly get us in a position to be open to it or not. But that's why religious traditions often talk about the element of grace in this event, meaning unpredictability, unproducibility, right? You can't make it happen. You don't know whether, when, or how this might happen to you. Let me just take a time out for a second to give you a couple similar experiences, something like conversion that we don't think of as in the religious sphere, but have some similarity. Okay, so some of you know the story of Billy Elliot, who was a ballet dancer in England. The story goes something like this in minimal form. There's a great movie, Billy Elliot, by the way. So he's an 11-year-old kid in a mining town in northern England. I mean, mining towns are rough and tumble. These are tough places. His mother has died. He lives with his father and his older brother, both of whom are miners, and they're both on strike, and there's tension, there's violence in the air in town. The father wants Billy to be tough, because that's the ethos in the town, and so he sends him to the gym to get boxing lessons. Billy doesn't want to do boxing, but he goes, you know, he's obedient. And when he gets there, for some reason, by coincidence, the ballet class that was supposed to be where it usually is couldn't be because there's a soup kitchen now for the striking miners. So the ballet girls, and only girls do ballet in this town, the ballet girls are there doing ballet. And Billy Elliot walks in and he's riveted, right? He sees something that he's never seen before that is so compelling to him. He knows something right then, right? It's immediate. So he asks the teacher, could I do this instead of boxing? And the teacher says, well, I don't know. And so she has him do a couple moves, and he's already talented. He's got what it takes to do this. So she accepts him. They have to hide it from his father. When his father finds out, he beats him and says, absolutely not, you may never do this. But there's no stopping him, right? He is compelled by this vision, an identity that he sees outside of himself there in this dance, not in any particular person, but that's it. And he knows from that point what he's going to do in his life. And finally, his father relents. He does do it, and he becomes one of the greatest dancers in English history. So it's a great story. I'm going to make up another one. Let's say BU student, sophomore, goes to the dentist, you know, when not in class, and she's sitting there and reading through the dentist's patriarchal magazine selection. There's Car and Driver, you know, Guns and Ammo, Sports Illustrated, and so rolling her eyes at her dentist, she picks up Scientific American, and she's thumbing through. There's an article on genetics or something else, and she sees one on plate tectonics, and she starts reading, and her reaction is, wow, this is amazing. And she goes further. Oh, incredible. She's riveted on this. And she reads all the way through. She reads through it again. And she has the sense of herself and all of us as walking around, not even knowing that we are surfing on huge surfboards of rock that are floating on molten stuff, and all of this is moving, and the earth is spinning on its axis. So she has this deep sense about what's important about this. She finishes the article. The arrogant dentist, of course, is late like mine. She doesn't care. She's riveted. She gets out her device. She's, you know, okay, plate tectonics. Then, okay, geology. Geology looks like, okay, what do they have? BU, good. Cross the river, really good. So she has this sense. And then she goes home after dinner. She gets online. She's up for 24 hours. She's going to be a geologist. She's going to do plate tectonics. She knows that, okay? So there's something incredibly powerful and immediate about that experience, okay? Now, I have to tell you, this has never happened to me. I've never had one of these, and I ended up in my vocation much more gradually. There's a controversy in Zen Buddhism about whether an awakening is sudden or gradual, and, well, in fact, it's both ways. But in my case, I went off, and my father was a sort of local businessman. We had a little family store, and I was a major in business, and he was willing to pay the meager little tuition at the state university to get an education, and my family did that. And but I, for whatever reason, took a course in Chinese philosophy, and I said, interesting. Never did anything like this. Took another course in philosophy. Took a course then on Buddhism, and I'm just being gradually, slowly pulled towards it. Canceled the business classes, you know, law school, forget it. And I can remember the phone call to my mother and father. Painful. I put it off and put it off, and I had to tell them that what I was going to do, and my father was stone silent. I could just see him fuming. And my mother, now, darling, we know it's exciting, but it'll pass, and you'll be okay. Said, no, Mom, not passing. I've been actually on it for a year now, and I'm going to be a religious studies major. Big shock, because I came from a totally secular family, too. Nobody was religious. And here I am. I'm going to be a professor. Nobody even went to college in my family. And I'm doing religious studies. Like, oh, no. So my father didn't even speak. It was a long time before we could work that out. In any case, so mine was very slow and gradual. It took place over a long period of time. So now I want to talk about a minute. What are the differences between these two examples? We did religious ones and ones that don't seem religious, but both Billy Elliot and the geo convert basically said the Jesus of geo said, follow me, and she did. Both had a sudden conversion. They both responded immediately, without hesitation, just like the disciples. In both cases, lives were activated and empowered. Right? They really, let's picture the sophomore as not really knowing what she wanted to do, and now she knows, and she's on it. A new direction was clearly established. So these are all life-changing experiences. They all felt a summons by something, a vocation, right? Something's calling them, whatever it is, and it's their identity. It's, you know, it's me, so I got to go. So my thesis is that they all experienced some fundamental part of their own identity in that to which they were called. So let me think about just the most important difference is that occupation isn't everything. It's huge, and let me warn you, never underestimate the importance of your work vocation in life. It's really important. But religious conversion is, by definition, or by the definition I'm employing, your ultimate concern, your central concern, what in Zen Buddhism is called the great matter, or the overriding issue of the very meaning of life and death. It's the central concern that has bearing on all other concerns. Okay, so you might be a really good dancer, a geologist, who still hasn't faced up to the meaning of your life as a dancer or geologist. You could also be a priest who hasn't faced up to that either, but in that case, you'd be a priest who wasn't really religious, or at least one without an awakening of faith. Okay, back to Buddhism, where we see that this initial summons or sense of a calling is just the beginning. It provides a compelling thought of enlightenment, right? This basic idea, or idea of the good, we say in Greek tradition, showing you where you need to go, but the discipline of getting there still lies ahead of you. Having encountered an image of your own enlightenment that is completely compelling for you, the task of earning the freedom to bring that possibility into actuality is now underway. The subsequent gradual movement from possibility to actuality is the full spectrum of the Buddhist path. You become, in effect, a follower of yourself, your highest identity or ideal. You pursue a compelling insight into what you really feel you ought to be. Faith or confidence, in the sense, empowers ethics as intentional self-sculpting. This way of thinking about what would motivate an awakening of faith came to me while visiting a Buddhist temple in Japan. So I'm in a wooded area where temples often are, and they're gorgeous. And it's a series of temples, and you're walking from one to another. And I walk up to a small one before the big main one, and I notice it's the kind of temple, it's just a small little cabin, and you don't really go into it. You go up to the front of it, and you look in, and you see on the altar there's the Buddha. But in this one, there's a curtain hanging down between you, so you have to bow in order to see the Buddha. But when you do, what you're staring at is your own image of yourself looking back at you in a mirror, right? So there you are on the altar as the Buddha, okay? So you see yourself sitting there outside of yourself in the place of the Buddha, in the place where the enlightened one ought to be, or should be. Or in my terms, you get a glimpse of what you sense now you ought to be or could be, and find yourself bowing down to that as a summons. Right? May or may not happen experientially, but that's the idea in these temples. So this image of faith is a matter of being impelled by something that fully aligns with who you are. Okay, so having considered the faith experience that initiates rigorous ethical self-sculpting, let's look at the end of the path. Inspired by a powerful thought of enlightenment, a conviction that empowers you precisely because it aligns with who you are, and having set out into meditative ethics, where you take these ideas on, the question is, does anyone ever finally attain it or complete the quest? And I apologize for being the agent of bad news here, but my answer is no. And my task is to persuade you that's not a bad thing. Okay, tall order, but here goes. Having gotten a convincing glimpse of who you really ought to become, and having found the energy to get moving towards it, you don't ever entirely arrive at that place. Now, you probably sense that I'm straying from traditional Buddhism here, and that's true. Obviously, many traditional Buddhists of all kinds would maintain and have maintained that although it's difficult and distant, in fact, you can attain final and complete nirvana that totally accomplishes what you set out to do. But I'm disagreeing with these much wiser Buddhists than me for two reasons. One, that this image of a goal in life can't really be reconciled with the basic principles of Buddhist thought, that all things are impermanent, interdependent with other things, lacking a static essence. And some of the great Buddhist philosophers have seen that, right? Second, that this image of a fixed goal line in life isn't the admirable ideal that it might seem. So here's why. So certain ideals really do align with your background, character, potential in a particular time and place. And when the personal energy and conviction for movement in life is awakening, you set out towards these ideals. However, When it occurs that through practice, energetic effort, other mechanisms of change, we alter ourselves by moving towards such an ideal, something extraordinary happens. Perspective changes. In acts of practice, the foundations are being established for us to reimagine and more comprehensively conceive of the ideal. Any movement towards an ideal establishes the conditions under which our perspective is elevated, thus affording at least a slight revision of the ideal itself, one that, in effect, alters the goal by enriching its conception. So ideals are, by definition, what stand out ahead of us, no matter where we stand. Okay, now, sorry. This is true even of the notoriously set-in-stone Ten Commandments. Ongoing debate throughout the history of Jewish and Christian thought enabled richer and richer conceptions of what living up to each commandment would actually entail. So the Jesus' famous line in reference to the law, where he says, you have heard it said of old, thou shalt not, whatever, but I say unto you, you know, thou shalt not do this, but I say to you, where he redefines what it means to be living up to that commandment. That's just one of many such elevations of the meaning of an ideal. Although the particular commandment appears to remain the same, thou shalt not kill, for example, the same through history, what the commandment means and what it requires of practitioners undergoes such far-reaching change that, in fact, something else is being commanded. Similarly, Buddhist history can be read insightfully as the unfolding of the thought of enlightenment, the experience of enlightenment through history. And as historical conditions and the practices aimed at enlightenment change, so does enlightenment, both the conception that people have of it and their experience of it. This change in ideals is true even within one individual life of seeking and also in whole traditions through history. So on both levels, individual. So if I set out seeking, it's changing. My ideal, my image of it is always changing if I'm making progress at all. And in a tradition that's moving along, as changes happen in anything, the ideal projected is changing, you know, through in the whole tradition. Understanding ideals in this vein as historically moving projections provides one way for us to understand why we always look up to ideals, never fully achieving the level of excellence they demand. It's structured into the nature of ideals always to stand out ahead of us as images of our potential perfection, projections of ideal ends that we know to be our own, but which we nevertheless cannot right now, actualize in full. As the point of departure from which those ideals are articulated shifts, so do the ideals. Structured into ongoing elevation of ideals, therefore, some degree of frustration and inevitable inability to complete the task based on our capacity always to envision more and more. But this is the same frustration built into any effort to improve in any serious domain of practice, from cooking to math to piano to golf. What we actually manage to do and what we feel we ought to be able to do are at every point along the way at variance. No matter how we improve, we can always catch glimpses of greater levels of excellence beyond where we are right now. Thus, maturation occurs, we mature not just in our capacity to practice an ideal, but also in our ability to envision and conceptualize that ideal. We get better and better at seeing what might be possible. So even Serena Williams, to take an example, knows that she ought to be playing better tennis, and at every stage in her brilliant career, she knows exactly what better would mean, even though that image has changed for her throughout her career. Okay, second, an obverse reason for our incapacity to occupy the level of our ideals is the ongoing development and deepening of introspection. Friedrich Nietzsche's genealogical insight that the advent of Hebrew and Christian theism had served to develop new forms of human self-consciousness was just the suggestion needed in order to begin to see the role that prayerful introspection and the mental image of God's omniscience have played in the development of conscience in the West. So here's what I mean. If you seriously believe that God always knows the quality of your inner thoughts, your motives, your desires, and everything else, you'll have plenty of incentive to become aware of your inner life too, the workings of which are otherwise unknown to us. Your understanding of God's vision of your inner life becomes, in effect, your own vision. When individualized theism, as opposed to the collective religion of earlier cultures, came into being, so did psychological introspection. Self-knowledge and self-assessment came into being as whole new domains of human awareness, came into history at those points. An analogous development of the skills of introspection occurred in the context of Buddhist meditation. Although for the most part, lacking the strong theistic orientation of Western religions, the deeper a Buddhist meditator looked for example, the three poisons, greed, hatred, delusion, the more likely it became that previously unnoticed signs of these or subtle traces of them would come to light. This is to say that the harder and longer you look within ourselves to judge whether, in fact, we've lived up to the particular thought of enlightenment that's ours, the better we will become at identifying ways in which we have not, in fact, lived that way. So introspective self-assessment, like any other skill, can be fine-tuned and enhanced to establish nuanced standards that were literally inconceivable before. No matter how good a nun or opera singer or skier you might become, your skills of critical assessment and self-judgment will always outstrip your accomplishments. As is the case with ideals, insufficiencies constitute a moving target. As we work towards eliminating weaknesses, deeper and more intractable versions of them will appear through the ongoing development of our skills of introspective self-assessment. Third reason why you don't have to worry about reaching the final finish line of your ethical thought of enlightenment, a reason even more basic than the previous two, is your fundamental human finitude. Frequently, the choices we face in life are not between clearly marked good and evil, but rather between conflicting goods or between two equally troublesome or harmful choices. We regularly choose what to do among a complex set of possibilities, many of which are well worth consideration, but not all of which can be chosen, can't be actualized. So I can't be the philosopher and the scholar that I know I should be, and the teacher advisor to my students, and the father, and the citizen of my community, and the mountaineer, and the friend, uncle, cousin, and neighbor, and so on, that my ideal tells me I should be. I know what a great neighbor is, but I'm not doing that because I'm doing these other things. So the finitude of my situation means I can't do it, right? So it's built into our human situation. Our sense of ought, what we ought to do, what we should do, is broadly expandable, but not our capacity to live in satisfied accord with that sense. Given these realizations, it's essential to deal wisely with the unachievability of our ideals without undermining our confidence and the determination of our efforts, which is our faith, our confidence, our energy to move ahead. Can't undermine that. So in Zen Buddhism, there's a chant that they do every day that's very like the one Professor Eckel read, which goes like this. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to enlighten them. Cravings and attachments are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality is boundless. I vow to comprehend it. The Buddhist path is uncompletable. I vow to attain it. And there you have it in authentic monastic monotone. So, they know there's irony here, right? It's very clear. They're after a goal that they know they can't achieve, but they use that irony to empower their movement further along the path. We've talked about the Buddhist idea of dependent arising, the claim that everything depends, essentially. It's also true of your possibilities and your achievements. What you can accomplish in your life just depends. Well, it certainly does depend on the quality of your choices, the energy of your motivation, the skill of your acts, and other internal factors. It also depends on countless factors and constraints beyond your control. Genetics, your upbringing, your education, the economy, political battles, your moment in history, cars recklessly driven by others, fires started by lightning, and go on and on. You can't control these things, right? So understanding these structures of human finitude imparts wisdom. From this point of view, self-flagellation over human limitations, of which Buddhists are sometimes guilty, along with Christians and others, are just unproductive and unwise. So the relevant challenge to you is to accomplish what you can, not what you can't, and the place to focus most deliberately is present possibility rather than past failure. So some of you probably know what's called the Serenity Prayer that is recited in AA and is attributed to a Christian theologian, Reinhold Niebuhr. It says, "Lord, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference." Okay, it's a brilliant little formula that gets a lot of this right. So a Buddhist version of it goes like this. Typically, they skip the "Lord grant me" part. They go right to the issue. So this is from Shantideva, 8th century. If there's a solution, I'm reading this out of the text. If there's a solution to the problem you face, then why are you sitting there wallowing in dejection? And what exactly is the point of wallowing in dejection if there isn't a solution to your problem? So Shantideva has this quality of railing at the reader. He's screaming at you, you idiot. So stop, your depression is pointless, just wasted energy, pathetic self-absorption. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. Do something worthwhile. Learn from the past, from your mistakes, but get going. There's another parable that relates to this in early Buddhist texts where the Buddha says, when you're injured in some way, you break your arm, or your roommate lies to you or cheats you out of money or something, or somebody screams at you some hateful thing, you're hurt by these things. When that happens, he says, it's like being hit by an arrow. It really hurts, any of those things. But he says, what we do with that injury will determine a lot. And he says, what we typically do, like somebody says something awful to me, accuses me of something, I recite that awful thing said over and over and over. Right? My anger's building. It's getting worse and worse. My heart rate is building. The Buddha says, that's like shooting a second arrow at yourself and injuring yourself further, so that you're deepening the wounds that are already there. If you can't accept what's already happened, figure out how to deal with it intelligently, and then get moving again. So the goal here then is a mature recognition of this finitude. Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dale Wright, the Gamble Professor of Religion at Occidental College. Professor Wright's lecture was titled Spiritual Achievement and Faith in Contemporary Buddhist Thought and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Philosophy and Religion. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director David Eckel. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.